the case revolves around a 58-year-old woman, Lori Bates, who's filed a human rights complaint after she says her supervisors embarrassed her over her washroom needs and even docked her wages, all because she has irritable bowel syndrome. She says the company installed a timer to record how long she left her workstation for washroom breaks. When she decided to go to the washroom, she had to activate a device that would show everyone in her plant the fact that she was on break. This, she says, was not only a refusal to accommodate a disability, IBS, but also something that caused her great humiliation. The employer, for its part, says that they don't want to discriminate or harass anyone. They said in this case, her washroom breaks were causing them to miss out on production targets and as such costing the company. Now, we know that employers have an obligation to accommodate disability. How far does that obligation go? I want to welcome into the show here John Pincus, a lawyer with Samfiru Tumarkin. It's good to talk to you again, John. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the obvious question here. Is the obligation to accommodate absolute? Like, no matter what, if someone has a disability, you have to move mountains and beyond to ensure their ability to work for you?
No, of course, there is not an absolute obligation to accommodate in any circumstances. A employer is going to have to show that it's going to cause undue hardship, but if they can show that something causes the legal term undue hardship, then they can justify not making certain kinds of accommodation. But in this case, I think it's going to be very difficult for a company the size of the one in question here, Magna. They're going to have to prove that basically her washroom breaks were what she was asking for would have threatened their viability as a business. And I think a company of that size is going to have a very difficult time doing that.
So it's not enough for them to be able to say there is a cost associated with it. It has to be a cost so significant that their business itself was threatened. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, so the way that it works is it has to be a quantifiable cost. It has to be a cost that relates directly to the accommodation, and it has to be something that really changes their business in a fundamental way. So that's going to be a lot easier for a small shop than for a large company that's really not going to feel it. Especially, I think in this case, the total cost to them that they ended up docking her was something like $600 over a period of, I don't know, weeks. That is not going to be something that's going to show up on the P&L statements of a company like this.
So yeah, someone could, you know, have a, you know, leave the food in the fridge a couple of days too long and they're out $600.
Right, right. So I really don't see the undue hardship argument succeeding here. To me, the only way that a company succeeds in a case like this is showing that they were unaware of the disability and that they didn't realize that was why the washroom breaks were required. But based on the facts that are coming out so far, that doesn't seem like that's the case. It seems like they knew and they're just claiming it would have been too much of an imposition on them. And I just don't see how that defense ever succeeds. So I would be very surprised if a case like this actually made it to a hearing.
How clearly defined is disability? Because I know there are ailments and conditions, but I wouldn't qualify them as disabilities necessarily. And I certainly would have put IBS in that category.
Yeah, I think that IBS is definitely going to fall within the purview of as disability as it's defined in the Human Rights Code. But it's a very, very broad range of conditions. Sometimes it's visible, sometimes it's not visible, sometimes it's from birth, sometimes it can be from an accident, it can develop over time, it can be physical, it can be psychological. It's really, really broad. I don't think that in this case the company would be taking any issue with this qualifying as a disability, because IBS is very clearly, very obviously would fall under that definition.
If you take the IBS out of the equation, an employee who just goes to the bathroom a lot, are employers allowed to do what is alleged in this case, which is start tracking and timing them?
I think that's bad form, and if you're doing that to one employee and not others, it would definitely raise questions. But there have been cases where employees have claimed that they're being harassed or discriminated against because of being docked for washroom breaks. And the truth is that in Ontario, the Employment Standards Act actually doesn't speak to washroom breaks, and it does say that you can take pay off for employees when they're not working. So some employers may be able to get away with that in certain circumstances. but certainly not if there's a disability at play.
And I know it gets a little bit away from the specific point here. I'm just trying to cover the bases for people listening in on the employer or the employee side, just to avoid a situation like this. What about smokers? Smokers breaks. I mean, this is something where I've heard people try to make the claim that an addiction is a disability. Is that something that's upheld in any of the labor law?
Yeah, I actually haven't seen that happen specifically. I think if you could prove that you required a break for smoking and you were being discriminated against because of that, then maybe that would be an issue. But what strikes me about that is that there's probably going to be a lot of people who are smokers at any given company. And so if you start making exceptions for one person, you have to start making exceptions for everyone. Definitely in some of the smaller or medium-sized companies, I could see an undue hardship argument there. Because if you're saying, well, okay, 30% of our workforce are smokers and some of them take very long breaks, if we were to just pay them through for that, we would actually feel that would be a serious hit. I could see an undue hardship argument. So I think it depends on the circumstances and it depends on the size of the company.
Size of company, is that something that plays into a lot of these complaints? Is there an assumption that bigger companies have the ability to weather a lot more than smaller shops?
Yeah, I think there is. The tribunal is going to be a lot harder on a company who make millions or billions of dollars in profits and have thousands of employees than a small operation with only three or four people, because it's much harder for them to deal with these things if you don't have those kinds of resources.
I know your firm had actually put out a bit of a commentary on this particular case, and I want to read one section here and get you to extrapolate, if I may. If what Bates alleges is found to be true, the damages awarded are likely to be significant, as the tribunal will want to send a message to employers, unquote. So it's not just that they'll get her to, or get the company to reimburse her anything they docked. It could go far beyond that.
Yeah, it wouldn't be out of the ordinary to see damages in somewhere in the line of $20,000, $30,000 or even more in a case like this. The scope of damages that a human rights tribunal awards these days is quite wide. So it could be significant. And what we call it is damages for hurt, damages for injury to feelings, dignity, and self-respect.
I know it may be incredibly difficult to speak to motive, but every large company I've ever worked with, worked for, or known of has, you know, human rights policies coming out the yin-yang. And to have something like this, which seems to be by all measure very obviously a violation, not a gray area, very obviously a violation, how does something like this really fly at all?
I think that it probably just went under the radar. You probably had someone in the human resources department who thought genuinely, maybe sincerely, that they were dealing with it properly, but either they were just completely ignorant to it, or just, you know, looked at it as a dollars and cents issue rather than what they should have been looking at it as a human being. To me, what's really inexcusable about what happened here is that not only were they docking her pay for this, but they were basically broadcasting the fact that she needed breaks to the entire assembly line, if what she's saying is true. And if what she's saying is true with respect to the teasing and what may have amounted to bullying, and for the company, it's pretty obviously foreseeable that could happen when you start broadcasting this kind of information. So that, to me, is the part that is a little bit difficult to comprehend in a case like this.
If an employer is accommodating someone for a disability, that very often might involve having to pull other people off their work to cover off. Is there an expectation that employers will keep someone's disability or need for accommodation confidential, or is it justifiable if other people are required to change their work to loop people in?
I think that you can give them a certain amount of information, but employers are definitely going to be expected to use an appropriate amount of discretion. And here, I don't see how you can justify sharing with everyone else that this person is taking frequent bathroom breaks. I think what the company would probably say is, well, the other employees need to know that this person is on break. But I would argue there would probably be more discreet ways to do that.
Well, and even then, I don't think this company would need to, because it's not like they were having any plan in place to have anyone cover her work, it sounds like. They were just hanging her out to dry.
Yeah, so it looked a lot more like shaming. And that's where I think this is really problematic, which is why I think that this individual, if what she's saying is found to be true by the tribunal, is likely to receive on the higher end of the damages scale.
And what does that scale go up to?
I mean, it really depends. There have been cases where damages have been awarded in the six figures, and it is very difficult to predict. I have a feeling that's probably not going to be the case here because it's not that kind of level of egregiousness. The kinds of cases where you see those sorts of figures are people who've been, you know, abused for years and sexually assaulted by their employers and things like that. I don't know if this case quite reaches that level, but it wouldn't surprise me to see a damages award in, you know, 20, 30,000. It's difficult to predict because there isn't a formula. It's a human being at the end of the day who's going to use their discretion and is going to be affected by the evidence one way or another.
If someone does take an employer to a human rights tribunal, there is a judgment and an award. Are they able to, on top of that, go after their employer conceivably through civil means? Or is the human rights tribunal, is that sort of the one bullet in the gun in these cases?
Well, this individual could have arguably brought everything together in court if they wanted to leave their employment and claim it as a constructive dismissal due to a failure to accommodate or a poison work environment. You can do those things together in a civil forum, but what you can't do is forum shop. So if there are things that are awarded to her in the Human Rights Tribunal, she cannot then go to the courts and ask for the same thing. So typically what we would do in a situation like this, if there's any indication that this amounts to a termination and there's interest on the employee side of treating this as a termination, then we would probably do it all together in the courts.
Very interesting. John Pincus joining me on the line, labor lawyer with Symphiri Tamarkin LLP in Toronto. Good to talk to you, John. Thanks for your time today.
Likewise. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Symphiri Tamarkin LLP. Contact us at 1-844-661-9065 or visit stlawyers.ca.